Welcome to the Bill Kelly Podcast. I'm Bill Kelly. Well, if talks with the province break down, QP education staff in Ontario have voted to strike. Does this mean a strike is imminent? Sluggish progress on confronting climate change has left our infrastructure vulnerable on the Atlantic coast. How is Ottawa's neglect going to affect us nationally? And we get the latest in Hockey Canada scandal with Dr. Ann Pegoraro, co-director of the National Research Council for Gender Equity in Sport. It's all coming up in the Bill Kelly Podcast, and it starts now.
Today on the Bill Kelly Show on 900 CHML.
Well, the headline is QP education staff in Ontario schools vote to strike if talks with the province break down. We're going to give you some details on that. Now, later in the program, Education Minister Stephen Lecce will join us. We wanted to try to have him on in this early segment, but we have to work with other people's schedules, and that's understandable, but he will be with us a little bit later on. But to start off the show and to start off the discussion on this, we are pleased to welcome to the program Laura Walton. Laura is the president of the Ontario School Board Council of Unions and an education assistant herself. Laura, thank you so much for the time. It's great to have you with us today.
It's awesome to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about where we are now. The strike vote happened. The overwhelming majority of your members voted in favor of this. Now, I want to clarify for our listeners, this does not mean there's a strike is imminent, does it?
Absolutely not. What this is a vote of support to the issues that are at the bargaining table and a commitment that workers are willing to fight to ensure that families, students, and ourselves get what we need in this round of negotiations.
So it's another tool in the kit, basically, to say, look, if things don't work out, this is an option for us. And legally, you have to go through this process, don't you?
Absolutely. By law, you do have to go through this process. And there are several more legal steps before a strike could even take place.
Because I'm just responding to some of the stuff I've heard, and I'm sure you've sent some of the emails and tweets that have gone out on this as well. Parents don't have to worry. It's not as if the kids are going to get yanked out of school later this week or something. There's negotiation to be done, and even if you get to a point where you figure there's an impasse here, again, you have to have a no-board report, and then there's notifications, yeah, etc. So there's a process here.
Absolutely, there's a process. And even enshrined within the School Board Collective Bargaining Act, there's a 5-day notice period for parents as well. So there will be plenty. But I think the real key thing is none of us want to go on strike. Nobody wants to remove services from kids. But what we know right now is that the level of service that is taking place in our schools is at a terrible level. There is not enough staff in place. There is not enough. Boards across this province are saying they can't hire and they can't recruit. And much of that has to do with our low wages and working conditions. These are issues that have to be discussed at a bargaining table and need to be dealt with. Right now we're seeing boards hiring unqualified staff. The reason that they're looking for unqualified is because they can't attract qualified staff to do this work.
What about the attrition rate, Laura? Maybe you could just fill us in on that, because it's happened in so many other professions because of the pandemic and because of lockdowns and because of a number of other initiatives. Some people just walked away and said, look, I've got to go find something else. Is that a concern with your members?
Absolutely. Every day I'm hearing from members who are just saying, I can't do this anymore. And that personal struggle is heartbreaking, because none of us became education workers because we thought we were going to be Fortune 500 folks. We became education workers because we care deeply about kids and their future. But we have to be able to afford to live, and we need to have working conditions that are safe. And right now, these things aren't taking place in our schools, and it's a problem.
All right, I want to get to the salary and the money aspect in a second, but let's talk about that work environment and some of the concerns. A lot of people are going to be familiar with the concerns during COVID about ventilation systems, et cetera. We were assured by the province that most of that has been looked after. Not completely, but it's in good shape now, much better than it was. And I think they kind of indicating that they can check that box. Can they?
Well, there's still a long way to go on ventilation, but the ventilation upkeep requires our folks. And we can't attract HVAC people to do that work because of the wage. But there's also working condition issues about short staffing. There's working conditions around violence in the workplace. These things long predated the pandemic, and were kind of pushed to the side by the pandemic. It's time to talk about it now.
Well, the violence issue is something that needs to be done, and that goes is very much tied into staffing, isn't it? It's, for instance, yes, when it comes to education assistants, who are members as well with you, it's workload and how many students each individual has to be in charge of, and you can't be in two places at once.
No, and if we could, we've already tried.
And I understand that frustration. I hear that from parents. I hear that from education assistants themselves, who are just saying, look, as you say, that we're not here to get rich. We're just trying to do our job. But if I have to run from one student to the next, and these are people that need attention and special assistance, but the ratios just seem to be out of whack here.
They're terribly out of whack. When I first started my career 20 years ago, I did have good ratios. When I left my school to do the work that I'm doing now, I was going between children every 15 minutes.
How can you get anything done in that way?
You can't.
Let's get into the financial end of it, because I know that's what the government seems to be talking about here, is that, nobody wanted a strike, and here they are with a strike vote right now, and they say they've offered what they consider to be a fair offer right now. And the money that's on the table right now is, well, I'll just read what the province is saying anyway. They've offered a 2% increase each year over 4 years for those making less than $40,000 a year, which is a lot of your members, and a 125% annual increase for those that are earning more than that. That's a kind of a two-tier system of salary increases. What's your response to that?
We do not negotiate two-tier agreements. That's the first piece. Every worker deserves the same, pay raise. But I think we also need to be clear, 1.25 and 2% at a time when inflation is at 2% for a group of workers that is the lowest paid, who already have seen an 11% of their purchasing power, chipped away by this government who had already capped our wages, or the previous government that froze our wages, is just not good enough. It's not going to answer the issues that are at the table right now.
Well, if you do that math, the numbers I saw last week, inflation's right now at 7.5%, and they're offering you 2%. If you were to accept that, if your members were to accept that, you're starting off in the hole, aren't you? I mean, we've just done a number of programs here in the last little while, and I know you know this, Laura, about people that can't put food on the table. Or if we do, well, can I pay the mortgage? Can I pay the rent? People are having to make some pretty tough decisions right now, and the money that's coming in here is going to be a factor in that.
Huge factor. And, this is a group of people who are already behind, and this government wants to put them further in the hole. They are not six-figure earners. They, on average, make $39,000 a year, and they just cannot cut anything else out of their budget. This is not a group of people who, they already aren't going, they're seeking food banks, they're seeking relief from family and friends for bills. They're not going on vacations. They can't afford that. These folks just want to be able to clothe their kids, feed their kids, and go to do the work that they love doing, which is supporting kids at schools.
Talk about the people that are involved in this. When we talk about CUPE, these are not the teachers. I want people to understand that. That's a separate negotiation, different contract altogether. But there's a significant number of people in support roles here. We've talked about the education assistants, but we're talking about custodians, office staff, and other folks that are basically the people that make the school run on a daily basis, I would think, Laura.
Yeah, no, they are. They're the backbone. So it's maintenance and trades, it's ECEs, it's speech language, it's clerical, it's IT, it's library workers, EAs, custodians. We have close to 700 different classifications that we represent, all of whom do integral work to, the schools, and they're often the unsung heroes. People don't see them.
Now, you mentioned something a second ago that I think is going to be key to this, and I'll ask Minister Lecce about this when he joins us later on in the program today, because many of the issues you've talked about here, as you mentioned, have predated COVID. These were negotiations that were going on. There was some concern about staffing levels, about ratio of education assistance to students, and frankly, with some of the other support staff as well. We know the stories, and if people don't remember, I'll remind them. The boards of education were actually opposed to a number of the things that the province was and the ministry was trying to impose at that particular time. They actually had, in many cases, had to get permission to go into reserves to cover some of these costs.
Yes.
And it was never resolved. And then COVID hit. And, of course, everything kind of got, as you mentioned, shoved aside. But these are issues that still are outstanding, and they're going to have to be addressed, I would think, at some point.
Yes. And that's what we're saying. It's time to start talking about these now. We do realize that it's coming out of, 2 years of pandemic. But if we don't fight now for our kids, when do we fight?
So what's your time frame on this? I know there's another set of negotiations scheduled.
Yeah. We're going back to the table on Thursday and Friday, and I'm really hopeful with bringing this mandate back to the table and bringing the issues that we have back to the table that this government will see. The table has turned. It's time to talk about a real deal and not continue to embarrass and undercut our folks.
Minister Lecce, and I'll ask him again when he joins us, has said they're going to stay at the table. I assume you're going to stay at the table until there's some resolution here?
Absolutely. Our goal is to get a real deal.
But staying at the table should not necessarily ensue just staring across the table at each other with no conversation going on. There's got to be some give and take here, I would think.
Absolutely. Yes. There needs to be, and it's time for the government to come to the table and talk about this. We haven't seen them.
Does it concern you, as somebody who's representing your union members, and as you mentioned, the average salary here is about $39,000, and this is important work that people are doing, of course. These are our children. These are the environments in which our children are learning, and these are the people that help students that need special assistance, of course. When they say, look at, you know, this is all we can afford to do right now, and then you get a story like last week where the government announces they have a $2 billion surplus. It's not as if you're saying, hey, we want a piece of that, but it kind of takes the air out of their balloon about, well, we're hard-pressed financially here.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's really where these folks are feeling so disrespected, right, is that you hear about this surplus and then you hear about a government that says that we don't have the money. It doesn't relate.
So you've got your position, and you've got the government's position on a situation like this. Your initial response, if I recall, was about an 11% increase, and that's across the board for all members. Is that right?
Yes. Sorry, I'm just heading into another interview. Yeah, we have asked for $3.25. There is not an 11% increase. It's a $3.25 increase.
And they're coming back with, 2% over a number of years right now. Are you looking for a long-term contract here?
Are we looking for a three-year contract?
Okay. So they have your side of the story. You have their side of the story. Are you confident that you can find some consensus here?
Yes. I am confident that we can come to a resolution, and I think we're going to come to a resolution. And I don't know if you can hear it behind me, but I'm sitting in a room with over 1,000 people who are supportive of the work that is happening right now in our school. And I think, you know, the minister needs to be clear about that. You can hear these folks. These are parents. They want us to have a real deal.
Well, I'll let you get to your meeting. This is important at this time, and we just want to make sure that everybody is fully aware of exactly what is happening. Laura, thank you so much for the time today, and we'll hopefully stay in touch, and there hopefully can be some resolution to this sooner than later, too. Thank you again for the time today.
You're welcome. Take care.
You too. Laura Walton is the president of the Ontario School Board Council of Unions. It's confrontational, at least it appears to be confrontational anyway, depending on your characterization. And I don't even want to say which side are you on, because, I mean, we should all be on the side of a better education system and the things that we want for that. And we've talked about the number of shortcomings within this system. And it's not pointing fingers at anybody. It's just saying, I think there's an acknowledgement on both sides that there's still a lot of work that needs to be done here. And these particular workers, of course, are key parts of that education system. Anybody who has a child with special needs and who needs special assistance in the classroom fully understands the importance of education assistance. And they don't make a ton of money, but it's important work that they do. And, of course, the custodial staff and the clerical staff, the office staff, at all these schools. These are the ones that are represented by this particular union, by CUPE. And I don't know if they're that far apart on these issues. And I'm hoping that this can get resolved and that we're going to find some resolution, some middle ground, I guess, on a situation like this. Nobody wants to see a walkout. None of it, the people that I've talked to that do this sort of thing for a living want to walk out. I mean, we want to get back to quote-unquote normal. And they're looking for some stability, I guess. And we all are. I mean, they're in the same boat that many other people are. This is not just about the education system. There's many people returning to work now after COVID restrictions and the mess that we went through economically with that. And we're all looking for some stability. You know, you get worried when you hear about inflation jumping like this. And, you know, what's going to happen next week, next month? The story this morning, of course, in the news that gasoline prices are going up again. That's going to have an impact on people's weekly and monthly budgets, too. So I understand the frustration. I understand the concern here. And I understand that the government's going to try to be as frugal as they can. That's what governments do, right? So we'll find out. And just to remind you, we are going to be talking with the education minister a little bit later on in the program and get his read on what's going on and what's going to be happening with the negotiations when they resume in just a couple of days.
You're listening to the Bill Kelly Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Interesting piece that was in the Toronto Star a couple of days ago, and I believe it's published in the Hamilton Spectator today. The title is Ottawa Has Neglected Some of Canada's Problems, and Now We Are All Paying the Price. The author is Heather Schofield. She's an economics columnist, of course, for the Toronto Star. And she joins us here on the program to talk about the article and, well, the rationale behind it, too, which is pretty significant. Heather, great to have you back on the show. Thanks so much for the time today.
Nice to be here.
We know the news stories. We all saw what happened, of course, with the hurricane. We saw what happened on the Atlantic coast. And we all know the many of the other problems you've outlined here. But I think we have to be cognizant of the fact that, look, the government can't control the weather, but they can control some of the things that should be done to try to mitigate some of this impact. And they're talking the talk, and they've been doing that for years, Heather, but they're not walking the walk a whole lot.
Yeah, I think, you know, you can roll your eyes at if you like, at environmentalists who are saying, okay, this hurricane that hit the Atlantic coast so hard is because of climate change. We don't know definitively that yet, but I guess I would make the point that it just really doesn't matter about that particular hurricane and the particular causes. What does matter here is that we are getting natural disasters more and more frequently because of climate change. And we've known that this was going to happen for ages. And, you know, it's been on the boil for quite a long time. Like, think about last summer when we had these atmospheric rivers in BC and the town of Lytton burned down. And then a couple months later was flooded. That was in BC. I mean, that's just one spot in Canada, right, that just keeps getting slammed over and over again. And we have, you know, there's hurricane season for sure. It comes every year. But this is, you know, really brutal to see all the houses swept into the sea and people without power for so long. So all of that really begs the question, okay, we know that natural disasters are more and more frequent. We know that they're going to, it's a problem that's not going to get any better because climate change is upon us. What are we doing about it? And this is not about cutting emissions. This is about building up our infrastructure to make sure that things don't get swept into the sea when the sea rises, or to make sure that things don't get washed away when floods come, or that they don't burn down when we get massive forest fires or so forth. How do we go about, you know, changing the way we build things and basically strengthening all our infrastructure that's already out there to make sure that we're not completely crushed with these natural disasters every time they come?
And that's not a rhetorical question anymore, because we've seen the damage that's been caused here. The concern I've always had is governments tend to be, you know, short-term thinkers. I mean, they're worried about the next re-election. They're not necessarily worried about what this is going to happen in 10, 15, 20 years. And it's easy to be dismissive of something. They say, well, we really don't have the money right now. We want to put this over here. We want to spend this on here. And we're committed to that, but it's going to be down the road sometime. Well, you know, in the meantime, as you say, the number of incidents like this are starting to pile up, and we have to ask ourselves, are we really as dedicated to this, not just the governments, but us, I think, as a population, are we as dedicated to this as we say we are?
Yeah, there's no doubt it's already costing us billions of dollars. And that price tag, I mean, there are various people that are crunching these numbers. We've had Budget watchdog in Ontario crunched some numbers just last week, and some pretty massive think tanks also look at the potential cost if we don't repair, and then what the costs are if we do, you know, actually deal with climate adaptation right now. And they all come out with the same conclusion, which is it's going to cost more if we just let things go. So we should do it now. The thing is, it's not sexy, as you say, like, you know, building stronger foundations and dikes and stuff like that. It's not the sexiest campaign promise to run on. But I think, you know, at this point, I mean, I think the resistance in politicians for the longest time was, okay, we can talk about climate change, but, you know, until it's in our faces, it's kind of a theoretical thing to many people. But it's not that theoretical anymore. It is here and it's causing damage. So, you know, there's a climate adaptation strategy that's supposed to be coming out by the end of November. It's kind of late. It's trundling along. But, you know, we will see some plans, whether, you know, with and hopefully money to go with it. But it's been slow in coming. But, you know, you bring up a good point. I mean, it's not just a government problem here. This is an everybody problem. You know, there's businesses are obviously very vulnerable to climate change. What are they doing to make sure that their balance sheets are not exposed, to make sure that their assets are not exposed, to make sure that they don't get washed away theoretically or really by you know, the natural disasters coming at us? And then on an individual front, you know, like, what are we, insurance is a big problem. There have been lots of talks for years about how to make sure homeowners are properly insured against, you know, natural disasters and flooding and so forth, and that people don't build or live in floodplains, and do we know where the floodplains are and so forth. But these are, you know, we're still talking, and there's been, you know, incremental progress. But I live near Ottawa. You know, my area just around here was flooded in you know, two times in 3 years past the 100-year mark, right, of flooding. Mm-hmm. Two times in 3 years, right? So why are people still living there in that floodplain? You know, there's an answer to that. You know, builders are not properly looking at the floodplain maps. The floodplain maps are, you know, they're on a website somewhere. Are they watching that? Are they compelled to not build there? You know, what about insurance? So, you know, people who are just left living there and their homes get swept away, are they left without a home, or what happens to that? You know, we have yet to come up with a very coherent answer on how to deal with all of those very kind of very practical, not very sexy things to deal with climate change.
Well, and that goes back. I mean, you know, we could probably spend the whole entire segment here just pointing fingers at this politician and that politician, et cetera. But I think the overarching question here is, do they have the political courage to do these sorts of things? And your point about the floodplains, I mean, I had relatives that were involved in that, the one up in the Ottawa area. And we've seen it happen here. I mean, you know, I know you know this neck of the woods pretty well. We had people a couple of years ago in the Grand River floodplain. And what was that house doing there in the first place? Well, somebody gave the okay. Yeah, don't worry about it. Yeah, I know it's on a floodplain, but hey, what are the chances? Well, the chances are pretty good these days that something catastrophic could happen like that. So we've got to be aware of that and simply not give in to say, well, we, you know, it's not going to happen here. That's something that happens someplace else. It's happening here now.
Yeah, and I would just say, you know, foot dragging is a problem broader than just adaptation here at home. You know, if we look at there's a whole push that we've been talking for years, again, to transition to clean energy and off of oil and gas because of emissions. But we've been talking about it for so long. And, you know, yes, there's technology, and yes, there's subsidies encouraging companies to think about broader solutions and so forth. But meanwhile, Russia invades Ukraine, and all of a sudden the oil price is up and down and all over the place. Europe is running short of gas. We don't know how they're going to get through the winter. Gas prices are astronomical. We are paying the price right here in Canada, right? We see it all the time every time we go to the pump. Our inflation problem is completely tied up in that energy problem. If we had perhaps moved faster on clean energy and transitions, we would have better options right now than just saying, you know, the solution right now for powers around the world is to go around looking for more natural gas for Germany and Europe, including putting some serious pressure on Canadians to produce more natural gas and somehow get it into the global system. That is a very clumsy solution right now. And our dependence on Russian oil and gas is just brutal. You know, we can just only wish that we'd moved a lot faster on clean energy transition.
Well, and even then, and I agree, it's a short-term clumsy solution, but it begs the question, why didn't you see this coming? Where's the long-term planning? You know, it's a rich resource, and, you know, the chancellor was just over here a couple of weeks ago, and basically the prime minister said, no, it's not going to happen. Sorry, you know, we're not going to invest the money in a liquid gas facility in the east that could actually be beneficial to you. Maybe instead of simply saying no, maybe that was the time to start that conversation and say, maybe we should start thinking about this long-term. because of the dependency on European people for Russian fuel. And you know, we could be part of the solution here, but it's easy for a government to simply say, no, we don't want to spend the money on that right now.
You know, I'm not sure if it's a government decision to make there. I mean, if there's going to be a market, I mean, the prime minister's case was there's no market right now for natural gas. So why would we go there? But if there's going to be a market, I mean, Germany has got to go in there and say, yes, we are willing to buy liquefied natural gas from Canada for the long term. This is not just, they can't just come and say, we need it right now, because it's not going to happen right now. You need to build it. And then we have to make it worthwhile. Right. So if they're going to, maybe they would, you know, they've got to be give and take on all sides here, right? That they have to make a commitment that they'll buy it for the long term. And of course, there's reluctance in Canada to invest over the long term, because the signals from the government and from governments around the world have been, we're moving away from oil and gas.
Absolutely. And you have to wonder how long term that's going to be, which segues nicely, by the way, into what you also wrote about in the piece about electricity dependency and the fact that we have not anticipated the fact that there's an increased need for a more efficient system right now. I mean, everybody applauded the federal and provincial governments for their commitment a few months ago to building EVs and building batteries and plants. That's going to put a strain on the system. And as you mentioned in the piece, now the Ontario government is rethinking the shutdown of the Pickering plant, and maybe we do need to spend the money to keep that plant up and running right now. I mean, nobody seems to connect the dots here and say, this is a great idea. I think EVs are fabulous and they're the future, as they should be. But do we have the infrastructure to do it? And the answer right now is we don't think so.
Yeah, exactly. And this is something that we've been talking about for years, about the many, many billions of dollars that's going to be needed in hydroelectricity in order to, I mean, if that is the clean energy future, which it does seem that we're heading in that way, if that's the clean energy future, Ontario's got a lot of work to do and Quebec too, and you know, across the country, to actually get ready for that. And why aren't we there? I've been writing about this for so long, about, you know, the many billions of dollars that it's going to be needed, and it can't all come from government, right? This has got to be, I mean, hydro, first of all, is provincial. Obviously the federal has a big interest in it, but this is a private sector investment thing too. So how do we get all three elements there, investing the billions of dollars that's needed basically right now in order to make this happen? And it's not just, you know, electric vehicles, that's a big deal in terms of policy, right? Both the federal and provincial government want to see Ontario in particular become a global power in making electric vehicles. It would replace the market share that we're losing in the auto sector right now. And, you know, it would use our critical minerals, and there's so much potential there. But right now it's a dream, because we don't have the infrastructure to even get it up and running. And so we have the federal government throwing subsidies at both the supply and demand side, and very heavily into the nitty gritty of how that market should work one day. Is that really the way we want to go? And are we going to be ready? If we've got government working on all sides of this thing, it seems to me that that's kind of a clumsy way of going about it. And I think back to in the last election campaign, there was a couple of announcements from the federal Liberals about green steel and putting a bunch of subsidies into making steel in a way that was really low emissions. But it turns out that in order to do that, yeah, you need a huge amount of electric power, and it's not there yet. And so, you know, it sounds amazing to produce green steel, but are we really actually ready to do that? Not yet.
No, especially, and again, because there's an incongruity there. You know, for instance, if back to the idea about energy and electricity production here, if they don't go with Pickering, and who knows if that's going to happen or not, Plan B is through four or five of these gas-powered energy plants. Did they not get the memo about how burning gas is actually bad for the environment? That's a step backwards.
Yeah, I mean, the world is rethinking natural gas right now, right? Because for this very same reason, we're just not ready with the alternatives. And so, okay, gas is not as bad as oil or coal in terms of emissions. So it seems to be the second best option, but it's still not the ideal option. Same thing with nuclear, right? It's not the ideal option, but we've been slow in getting the ideal options up and running and at scale, so we're stuck with that.
A fascinating piece, and as I say, for our Hamilton listeners, it's available in the Spec today. It was on the Toronto Star. I think it's still on the Star webpage anyway. And it puts into context, I think, some of the concerns and some of the challenges that we're facing when it comes to energy and government's visions, or lack thereof, I guess some people might want to suggest. Heather, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for this. I really appreciate our conversation.
All right, my pleasure. Have a great day. Have a good Thanksgiving.
You too. You betcha. Heather Schofield, Ottawa Bureau Chief for the Toronto Star, and of course, economics columnist for that Toronto chain as well, the Torstar chain.
You're listening to the Bill Kelly Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Earlier this morning, of course, we had Laura Walton on the program, the president of CUPE's Ontario School Board of Unions. 97% majority of Ontario education workers have voted in favor of strike action if they can't get a new deal. But as Laura told us earlier this morning, nobody wants a strike.
We don't want to be forced to stop doing the work we love. We don't want to go without pay just to get a good deal for students, parents, and each other. But education workers have said very clearly, if this government will not budge, we are willing to strike for a contract that is good for students, for families, and for workers.
That was their position on this, as you heard earlier on our program. We want to find out how the government is going to respond to this, and to do so, we're so pleased to welcome back to the program the Ontario Education Minister, Stephen Lecce. Minister, pleasure to have you back on the program. Thanks so much for the time today.
Thank you, sir. Good morning.
Where are you with the negotiations at this point? I know that you've had some discussions right now. You've got more talks scheduled for later this week, we're told. Right. Clearly, there's a line in the sand here, or is there? Do you feel that there's still some wiggle room here?
I think the union has made a determination that they want to proceed potentially with a strike, notwithstanding the last 2 years of pandemic disruptions for kids. I am disappointed, but as I've noted, I am not surprised, because we've seen this story before. To hear the president say, we don't want a strike, except over the past nearly five decades, that is precisely what education unions have done when they've not gotten the demands they've imposed on the government of the day, of all political parties. So, I mean, look, I think there's a path to a deal. I do believe that. I think a lot of this happens in negotiations, a little bit of rhetoric on, you know, in theater, and that's fine. I just think that we got to keep in mind there are parents watching, and they're anxious, and these kids simply want to be in school. And the premier's given me a clear mandate, fight to ensure children remain in school. That's what we're going to do. And my hope is reasonableness will prevail, because we've offered 8% to workers over the course of our program. We're maintaining the best benefits, literally in the nation, the best pension, perhaps among some of the industrialized world. I mean, we talked about the teacher pension plan, education plan is solid, and 131 paid sick days. Yes, I do believe it is reasonable, recognizing these people play an important role in our schools. And honestly, I'm very grateful for what they do. We couldn't run our schools without them. So that's why I thought our proposal was reasonable. I think when I hear a, you know, give us nearly 50% increase in compensation or else we'll strike, I do think it's unfair on the kids, and frankly I think it's unaffordable on the taxpayer.
On the other side of the coin, though, I mean, when you look at their current situation, well, even the short history of this, well, the previous government, not yours, but the previous government froze their salaries. Your government has put a ceiling on them. In the meantime, we've had runaway inflation, which is impacting you, me, and everybody else, including them. So you can understand their frustration and their angst about what's going to be happening going forward.
QP workers, education workers of this province, play a critical role, and I thank them if they're listening for the work they do. We pay them on average $27 an hour. A education worker in a school makes more than their equivalent in virtually every sector in the economy. The same job in a hospital, they're making more. Same job in a college, in a university, in a transportation sector, in finance, in manufacturing, in literally every industry equivalent, they make more. Wages have been at or above inflation over the past 20 years. There is literally over 10,000 additional education assistants in our schools. These are the workers we're talking about in part because of hiring over the past 20 years, even though the student population has remained frozen. So we are adding more people. Part of this proposal we've got before the union is actually to hire 1,800 more for the coming year and every year over the course of this contract, more staff to provide a critical role. But our wages, you know, on average is around $49,000 for a worker. And I do believe when looking at compensation, when you add it all together, and I do believe when you're adding 2 points per year, you're maintaining the best pension and benefit program and 131 paid sick days. Look, I think that is a reasonable offer. And the question I ask for you, Bill, is for people listening today, folks, Could any of you tell me if you are eligible for a nearly 50-point increase in compensation? And I'm asking, obviously, a bit of a rhetorical question. We know the answer. Virtually no one in this economy is. So I'm asking for some reasonableness. I'd rather money flow to kids than to increasing compensation among a sector that is already literally amongst the highest paid in the nation. And I think, yes, they play critical roles. Yes, inflation is high. Let's just be reasonable. Come up with an offer that is affordable and, frankly, does not create an impact on the taxpayer, because whatever I sign with QP becomes the literal floor, the minimum in the teacher unions. That becomes the minimum standard in our negotiating position. They get that or more. So it's nearly $20 billion sector impact. $20 billion is more than the entire education budgets, you know, of the Prairie provinces combined. I mean, this is not insignificant money, and it's going to have to come from somewhere. And we're not going to raise taxes. We're not going to cut essential services, critical services, to do this. So I'm just asking for some reasonableness to prevail. This strike action is disappointing, but it's obviously a reminder for me of how critical the in-person learning experience has been. And I've seen, like you, I'm sure you saw, you see these kids. They're happy. Yep. And honestly, you can't quantify that. I don't know how you know, to see their smiles and see them engaged in learning. It's even the teachers are telling me that they're happy to be back. So let's just stay in school, stay at the table. Let's get a decent deal we could all live with.
Final question, the same one I asked Laura Walton just a little while ago when she was on the program. Mm-hmm. Given the circumstances here, and as you say, the scenario that's being followed right now, there is some wiggle room here, you feel. You go back to the table later on this week. Are you confident that there can be a solution here?
You know, I'm confident that the offer we've brought forth is reasonable, affordable, that they're already among some of the highest paid equivalents in the country. Having said that, last time I went through this a few years ago, and the government went through this with this union, there was rhetoric and all types of stuff happening right up into the end, and you'll remember that late Sunday night, we got a deal. We can get a deal. It just requires all the parties to put students at the forefront of this discussion. And when you're starting the negotiation off in the summer with a commitment to a strike, or rather a strike vote to enable a strike, before the government even introduced or brought forth our first proposal, it wasn't particularly a promising early step. But yes, I do believe we can get there, and I think kids deserve that effort. The context of striking and strike votes, it suggests that you're prepared to leave the table. And I frankly believe on a moral basis, given all the impacts of learning loss that is so massive in math and literacy too, when it comes to mental health, physical health, I'm imploring the union to stop this story that happens every couple of years for the last nearly 50 years in Ontario. Work with us. Let's come up with something we can all live with. It doesn't have to be perfect. It has to be fair for your members, it has to be good for kids, and preserve stability. And that is exactly what I hope to advance this week, and frankly every week, as we continue negotiating with all of our education partners.
Ontario Education Minister Stephen Lecce. Minister, thank you so much for the time. Really appreciate it. And good luck to everybody involved going forward. Thanks for this today.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You're listening to the Bill Kelly Show podcast on 900 CHML.
The story about Hockey Canada seems to be getting worse and worse as we get more information. President and former members of Hockey Canada's board of directors are sitting before a heritage committee in Ottawa. They've been doing this for the last couple of days to answer more allegations of financial impropriety stemming from a report that a second fund was actually set up to deal with sexual assault allegations and other lawsuits. Global's Claude Figg has the details for us.
If they thought they faced tough questions the last time they sat before a committee in Ottawa, present and former members of Hockey Canada's Board of Governors can expect an even bigger earful later this morning after new allegations surfaced Monday, with the Globe and Mail reporting that the organization had set up a second fund to pay off sexual assault claims and other lawsuits.
I feel like I'm lacking vocabulary right now to express, because the stories keep on coming out.
And for Minister for Sport Pascal St-Onge, no matter the explanation, there can only be one solution.
What we're all expecting and what I'm expecting is for executive management resignation at this point.
Claude Figg, Global News.
It's a troubling situation for everybody involved in this. And what are the solutions? Well, I think the minister just had a pretty good idea there. I'm not so sure that's going to even happen, too. Try to get some perspective on this. We're pleased to welcome back to the program Dr. Ann Pegoraro, who is the co-director of the National Research Network for Gender Equity in Sport. Doctor, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time today.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
You get a bad situation going worse. I mean, it was bad enough that they did this. They didn't tell us about this. So they didn't tell us about the payments. Were you surprised that there was a second fund set up too?
Yeah, I guess I kind of was, and I don't think I'll be surprised anymore. I think that's the that's probably the last piece of surprise I had, mainly because they've testified twice in front of Parliament on these hearings and never disclosed this fund.
And this is guilt by omission, by the way. I mean, they're going to say, well, you know, you didn't ask the right question. That seems to be the implication we're getting from some of the boards. But it does kind of indicate that they're being less than forthcoming here.
I do. And I think in all of the, communications, whether they're answering questions, whether they're putting out their own PR, they have been less than genuine in all of it. And I think, maybe it's finally the time for the Canadians to call them on that.
I guess one of the most troubling aspects of this, I mean, the fact that it happened is bad enough, but the fact that they figured they had to have another stream for this indicates the magnitude of the problem, the number of allegations of sexual misconduct that went on here. We talked about that one particular time with the national team, seems like a long time ago now. This is epidemic.
Absolutely. And we're seeing more reports coming out from every sport that is epidemic. But the difference, I think, with hockey is they, as opposed to dealing with changing culture, have just been setting up large multi-million dollar funds to pay out victims rather than actually stopping the behaviors and changing the culture in their sport. They're just sweeping it under the rug with millions of dollars.
And as we said, I'm assuming we'll get more details about this as time goes on. But these, as you mentioned, are settlements. I mean, even in the case of the first payout that we found out about the members of the national team, there was no investigation, no charges related. There was no accountability. The people that were alleged to have been the perpetrators in this basically got off with nothing.
Yeah, and we're seeing it. I think there's another report that was narrowed significantly in scope around the Canadian Hockey League that Sheldon Kennedy was a part of. So we see this culture in hockey as a sport. We're seeing it in all sports, but I think acutely in hockey in terms of, rather than bust open the doors and let's take a look at how ugly things are, we're going to narrow scopes. We're not going to actually involve police. We're going to try to keep this in-house, and we're going to try to just pay off people and hope it goes away.
The wordsmithing on this, it's mind-boggling, really. The second fund is called the Participants Legacy Trust Fund, created by the organization and its members for more than $7.1 million from the National Equity Fund. Here's the quote that just rankles me. The money was earmarked, quote, for matters including to, but not limited to, sexual abuse. Apparently, the overwhelming majority of this was for sexual abuse, but they tried to couch that by saying, well, it could be for people who come back years later because of aggravated injuries. Notwithstanding the fact that their legal representation, I guess, doctor, said that there's a statute of limitations on those injuries. You can't come back 25 years later and say, I hurt my knee, I need compensation. But you can if it's sexual assault. I mean, so clearly they're concerned here, I guess, about the plethora of number of allegations that are coming forward here.
I would think internally they know, they're getting these all the time, and they're probably very much concerned that this is going to keep rolling out, particularly now when the limelight is shining pretty hard on them. Every victim out there should be coming forward if they can with support to be able to, tell their stories and or access this money, because obviously Hockey Canada is willing to pay it. But the more people we have bravely telling their stories, the better hope we have that the groundswell will help us change sport in Canada.
You and I have talked about this in past discussions, and you just alluded to it a second ago. We've kind of been asleep at the switch. I mean, this is apparently an ongoing problem, not just in hockey, but in many other facets of sports too. We talked about the gymnastics team, the soccer teams, those are the ones that come to mind right off the bat. I'm sure there are many, many more in situations very similar to this. We haven't been watching, and as a result, a lot of people have suffered.
Yeah, I think we've been watching differently. We've been watching success. We've been watching medals. We've been cheering on athletes, and we haven't been paying attention to the signals that those athletes have sent us, in particular in high-performance sport. Rowing put out a report yesterday about verbal and physical abuse in their sport. We saw bobsled and skeleton have to call their general meeting because they were getting the governance there was getting attacked. Big report came out of the U.S. on women's soccer yesterday. They're just unfolding continually. And I think that we've been very caught up in watching success of athletes and cheering for medals. and not really taking a good look at what the system is that's producing those metals.
Where's the breakdown here? Is in the accountability? Is it oversight? What's not happening that should be happening?
I think it's a system that's been crafted in a way to focus again on sporting success, and that if I'm inside the system and I see something, I have to weigh the pros and cons of reporting that versus the success of winning a medal and the money it brings to my organization. And so we've got CEOs of national sport organizations, provincial sport organizations that have to balance solvency, financial solvency, versus the abuse that's happening in their players. Because uniformly we're seeing that the harassment and abuse that are happening to athletes are also usually coming from successful coaches, and that's where people turn their eyes.
So in other words, if you see something or experience something, even worse, I suppose, you say nothing because the accusation is going to be a level that, well, you're ruining our chances to win now. Thanks a lot for that.
Absolutely. And those who have come forward have either been, you know, kicked out of the sport or gaslit that they're not telling the real truth. And so we see that over and over again. And so that is a culture of silence that's been in most Canadian sports we're starting to hear now.
So was there a structure in place that was being ignored, or do we have to revisit this whole process about accountability?
I think that we need to revisit parts of it. I think the structure, you know, is good at some levels, but I think that the way that sport's been allowed to police itself and stay very internal has created this sort of festering of this situation. You know, finally, we do have this Office of Sport Integrity that's an external agency. You know, we heard, if we go back to hockey as an example, most recently they selected the lawyers that you'd have to talk to if you wanted to, and they paid them. So how's that a real investigation of a system? Those lawyers are paid to protect. It's the same lawyers they brought to the hearings. So now we have this national system, and we're struggling to get organizations to sign on to it. We need every national sport organization, and then we need mechanisms at the community sport level all the way through the system to allow individuals to come forward without bad recourse and to have independent investigations.
I mean, in the past, I'm overstating this just to make my point, but it just seems as if these organizations, multifaceted organizations, different sports, basically said to the government, just give us the money and we got this. We can handle this. Okay, we're fine. Can we cut them that much slack again going forward?
I don't think so. I think that the government, rightly so, we hear from the minister already by the freezing of funds. I think we now see a government and a sport minister who's going to create a system of checks and balances that didn't exist before. Ways that when you get your money, you must report. You know, I think I'm hopeful that we're moving towards some sort of proactive set of standards for the system that would allow us to put a seal of approval or disapproval on a sporting organization based on how they're reporting in terms of what exists inside the organization to stop this kind of abuse, to create a positive sport experience for Canadians.
I mean, the fact that the sexual assaults is happening is egregious. That's terrible. The fact that they seem to have swept them under the carpet without investigation is even worse. And this is maybe not the most magnificent cry, but it's one of the things that concerns about what the parents of the people in Hockey Canada that paid their fees every year, which they assume was going to go for the betterment of the sport, you know, the, any number of different things that had to happen to try to enhance the sport, the training, the enjoyment of it for people that are involved in this, men and women, young girls and boys. The fact that Hockey Canada would actually take that fund and use it for this purpose. As if I were a parent involved in this, and I know thousands and thousands who are, I'd be insulted and angry, frankly, that they're using my money without my permission to do something like this.
Absolutely. And I think we have to remember that hockey belongs to to parents, to participants. Hockey Canada does not own Hockey in Canada. And the power is in the members of that organization. Those are the parents, those are the participants, and they're the easiest and best leverage for change. I'd be outraged if my money was going to pay off this as opposed to changing and creating a safe environment for my child. And I think those are the voices that need to be heard now. Parents can vote with their feet by removing their children from the sport or refusing to pay those fees to Hockey Canada, and they can demand the change. We know participation in hockey is going down. This could be one of the reasons. But it is our national game, and it belongs to us as Canadians, and I think we have the right to demand that change.
Including, and I know the minister's talked about this on a couple of different occasions, financial oversight. If they're whether it's corporate, whether it's government money, whatever the case might be, as parents, as you say, people that are involved in this. I mean, we're shareholders, I guess, in this whole situation. We're sending our money over there. Don't we have a right to understand exactly how much they have, where they're spending it?
Absolutely. 100%. You're right. We're like the shareholders of Hockey Canada, the people who pay the fees to put their children into the sport. And we have a right to know. And we're seeing now that a large chunk of that money is not about growing the game, not about getting better coaching, not about more infrastructure, not about building a pathway for my child to go from, you know, peewee all the way through. It's about paying off egregious behavior by the athletes who are already in the system ahead of my child. So if I'm a parent, I'm livid. I deserve to know exactly the accounting for this money, and we deserve real transparent management from Hockey Canada.
I know one of the questions that's going to be asked today is basically, how many cases are you dealing with right now, or how many have you dealt with? Because they're pretty forthcoming about this either. We really don't know the magnitude of the problem. I mean, there's a dollar figure, but how many people have come forward? And I guess to your point, Doctor, how many are going to come forward now?
Yeah, and I think that I feel like we're past the point where we can expect the transparency from this current leadership. I think the sport minister's called for it. I think many MPs have been calling for it. I think parents, I think Canadians, in answering the polls and the questions that are going out there, are all saying that the Hockey Canada needs a complete overhaul at the leadership level to get us that kind of information, to move to transparent. The only people that don't seem to get this is the people inside that organization themselves right now.
Well, I don't know if they feel as if they're protected. I mean, they did offer up Mr. Brindamore, as the sacrificial lamb, but that's not enough. I mean, it's even subsequent to him leaving, and the interim had Ms. Skinner going into that position. We're starting to get more things uncovered here. I mean, you know, it's a pox on all their houses. I mean, we really don't need any or should have any of these people involved in this anymore, I would think.
No, and they all have long track records inside the culture of that organization, 20 years, 2 decades, you know, plus for some of them who are in those senior management positions. How can they, who've been indoctrinated into the culture of what they've done around silencing victims, be the ones to make this change? They don't know any different than the operating that they've been doing for the last couple of decades. So I hope that they're going to resign, but I've lost faith in them as an organization to really see to see what the best path forward for the game in Canada, not for themselves, but for the game in Canada.
Is it prudent at this stage for legal authorities, police, RCMP, I don't know who in this particular circumstance, since the national situation, to obtain or seek these records so they can find out exactly who has been charged and who has been accused in situations like this?
Yeah, I sort of wonder, you know, if they've cleaned this up without involving the police, have they covered up crimes? And that to me is obviously something that we should be concerned about, but also that the legal system in Canada should pursue. I think a full audit financially to see if there's been misappropriation of funds to do these activities really outside of the mandate that they have as an organization. And I know the MPs are calling for a full audit. So I think both sides, we need a look at the legalities of the way that they've operated and the way that they've managed the money.
I know we're almost out of time. I want to take 60 more seconds if I could and get your reaction to this survey that Hockey Canada actually sent out to some of its members. Quite a bit of pushback. This is a questionnaire, basically. And the one that jumped out right now, do you strongly agree or strongly disagree? The level of criticism by the media towards Hockey Canada is overblown. That's one of the questions they wanted people to ask. Or answer, rather, in situations like this. They're very self-serving, and the timing on this stinks.
Yeah, I mean, to me, this is something that is a distraction. It's them trying to get a positive spin on their situation. And it again shows their lack of understanding of the situation, inability to read the room and actually make change. What I hope doesn't happen is today's hearings don't focus on that survey. It's a survey. What we need to be focusing on is actually what's happening inside that organization and not the distraction of their PR moves.
Exactly. Doctor, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for continuing the conversation.
You bet. Dr. Ann Pegoraro, co-director of the National Research Network for Gender Equity in Sport.
The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on 900 CHML.
The Bill Kelly Podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. You can also listen to The Bill Kelly Show weekdays from 9 till noon on 900 CHML. I'm Bill Kelly. Thanks again for listening. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. It's free, so you never miss an episode. And make sure that you rate and review.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.